This is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio. Catholic Review Radio is a weekly radio program and podcast hosted by Catholic Review Media, the news operation of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic partners for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to our listeners each week.
Welcome to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. If Catholics know anything about St. George, it's probably the legend of how the saint slayed a dragon. While the dragon-slaying tale of St. George is most likely mythological, the saint is not. But who was this elusive figure? With the Feast of St. George coming up on April 23rd, we are joined today by Hanel Bianchi, a professor of history at Howard Community College, who holds a doctorate in British history from the Catholic University of America. Hanel is the author of St. George's Day, A Cultural History of England's National Holiday. He is a parishioner of St. John in Westminster and also blogs for the Catholic Review. Hanel, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's great. And it's a real honor to talk about St. George.
So how did you develop an interest in St. George?
So as I was doing my doctorate, I was really interested in the area of cultural secularization. So I want to look at different things and see how it went from church control to like state control to maybe corporate control. And St. George kind of represents this like perfect example. Okay, you have the saint and all of a sudden he becomes a dragon slayer. Then he becomes a national symbol for England and many other countries. And now on St. George's Day, unfortunately, it's a little bit like St. Patrick's Day. The main promoters are beer companies trying to sell alcohol. So how does culture, which was originally created and generated by the church, be taken over by these other institutions? And I thought that St. George was a really good vehicle to study that. And then over the course of 5 years of studying him, I ended up having a great devotion to him. So I didn't really have the devotion first and was interested, but more of the topic. And then he kind of led me to kind of admire him as a saint in the end.
He's such a legendary, mythological kind of figure. What do we know about the actual saint, the real man? What kind of factual information do we know about him?
So that's a real difficult question. I wish somebody would probably take 5-10 years to write that book. So if you're good at ancient languages and you're looking for a history project, that'd be perfect. But so nobody's ever done it. And what we do is we have just a bunch of pieces of information, and they're unfortunately conflicting. So we have the very first document, unfortunately, it's from a pope in the 5th century saying, don't read the life of St. George. We know he's a saint, but the sources are unreliable. And what historians have done is they've had two families of kind of early lives of St. George. Some are apocryphal, just like we have more than four gospels, right? And the church then picked the four and said, hey, don't read these other gospels. And then eventually we get a canonical version of the life of St. George that is approved by the church. So from the very beginning, there's this controversy on who he is. Now, what historians can do is look at all these sources and say, all right, what are they having in common? So what they have in common is they all mention that he's martyred. That's the clearest thing. The vast majority of these stories are that he goes under real extreme tortures and eventually dies for the faith. So that's crystal clear. The other thing in all the sources, whether they're condemned by the church as being apocryphal or accepted, he's a soldier. So he's part of the Roman military. The other thing is there's a lot of different locations in the Middle East, but typically it's from the Eastern Mediterranean, probably dying in Palestine, maybe coming from present day Turkey, from Cappadocia. And so it's all around that territory. That's another thing that we would know. But those are kind of the basic facts. The emperors kind of change in different stories, but eventually the church settles and says it's under the reign of Diocletian. Now, was it Diocletian himself or a local Roman leader that persecuted and killed him? Again, that's somewhat debatable. But we know those elements, that he stuck up for his faith as a Catholic soldier, and as a result, he was killed for it. Now, in the apocryphal ones, and this is kind of why it was condemned by the church, he's killed four times. So three times he's killed, and he actually is raised from the dead. And he experiences 7 years of torture. And I think the Catholics perhaps at that time are trying to show he's really holy by all these tortures. But in reality, the canonical version kind of reduces it to a shorter period of torture and that he's eventually killed. And he converts a lot of people as well. Even the wife of either the emperor or the local ruler converts to Catholicism by his witness. And of course, there's miracles that go along with the torture. So I say that these basic elements are in all the stories, but again, the length of punishment and where it is located kind of might change from story to story.
Do we know if he himself was a convert?
We don't know a lot about his early birth, early life, right? So these are really basically the passions. They're not life. So he kind of appears on the scene. His name, George, actually means farmer. So he has a lot of connections to farming. So he's probably maybe a farmer. But again, I don't think we know a lot about his parents or his background, because it kind of just jumps all the way to him protesting the edict, which is like condemning. And some stories say that the edict to condemning Catholics, he goes and actually rips it down. He does this public protest. And another time, and I'll just add one more thing. And I know this isn't answering the question, which is, I don't know, but it's a great story of him saying, hey, I will worship the Roman gods. And he goes to the temple. And then instead of worshiping the statues, all the statues are destroyed. So there's these public elements of protests. But unfortunately, we don't know anything about his early years.
I think you said in your book that the whole dragon slaying story didn't develop until 800 years after his death. How did the whole dragon stuff come about?
That's a great question, because a lot of people look at him and see he's just purely mythical, right? That he's a Christianized version of these heroes that are killing monsters. But he existed as a martyr for 800 years. So what happens in these stories? The emperor or the Roman leader is described as a serpent or as a dragon. So they're using that word as an adjective. Right? So that's what happens in the early accounts. Okay. Then what happens is that he's starting to be depicted in images, first killing a person. So he's depicted as a soldier killing the emperor, perhaps, as a symbol of evil. In some of the stories, actually, the emperor is killed after the martyrdom of St. George. Fire comes down and kind of strikes the emperor, and it brings about the death of the Roman leader. And so that's the first element of the this iconography. And then what happens is that the person that he's killing kind of changes into a serpent. So it's a symbolic shift. So we see this with St. Michael the Archangel, for example, killing the devil, but it's kind of like a serpent figure. And so we see these images kind of around the 11th century that he's killing a dragon. And so what happens is that the Western knights come to the Middle East, the Holy Land, doing the Crusades, and they see these images of a knight on a horseback killing a serpent. And so it's from this image. And then we don't know exactly who comes up with the idea, but eventually in the 12th century, for sure, with the golden legend, they've kind of taken some stories from the Greeks or from any other local tradition of a hero killing a serpent to save a girl and insert that into his story, where there's a dragon terrorizing the village and they're putting sheep, and eventually they run out of sheep, so they put children, and then the princess is picked. And he basically saves her, takes the dragon, and kills the dragon, and converts the kingdom to Christianity. The king, of course, very grateful that his daughter has been saved. So it's a very slow progression. Yes, it's an insert, but that's not how he started off. It's a story that's added to him through a kind of a mix of images, and then inserting these older legendary stories into his account of being a martyr.
And I think you said that even some of the fighting implements, the weapons he's depicted using they're medieval weapons.
As he's a Roman soldier. And when the Crusaders come over, they're looking for a patron. All right. They're looking for somebody to help them in battle. And in the East, St. George is incredibly popular. He's a warrior saint. So they take him as their own, and he becomes a knight. Okay. And it's in these conflicts with Islam, in particular, even a little bit before the Crusades, they start praying. These Western knights start praying to St. George for his intercession. And what we see is that St. George appears to them doing the Crusades. And so the chronicles write that they're praying to St. George, and St. George appears before the battles. And then it kind of does get a little bit more, I think, embellished in the firsthand chronicles say he appears. And then if you look a little bit later, St. George actually shows up and fights in the Crusades. So he's helping them, and not as a bystander, as just a heavenly intercessor, but he actually comes and fights with them in the Crusades. And so what ends up happening when the knights come back to Europe afterwards, St. George is a patron of all these knightly orders across Europe. The monarchs that have participated in the Crusades, they come back and St. George is a patron for them. So he very much in between the martyr and the dragon slayer, he is a medieval knight as well, and a patron of chivalry for all the medieval knights of the period.
Well, our guest today is Hanel Bianchi. He is the author of St. George's Day, A Cultural History of England's National Holiday, and also a parishioner of St. John in Westminster. And we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm George Matisek. You're listening to Catholic Review Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world with the Catholic Review. Catholics who worship at parishes in Baltimore City have the opportunity to weigh in on the proposal for Seek the City, the archdiocesan process underway for nearly 2 years, to change the footprint of physical locations in the city while emphasizing a Eucharistic vision and a renewed vision for the city church in Baltimore. Jerry Royale Bird, director of the Seek the City to Come process, said the team and consultants are still listening and considering feedback. Priests from the 61 parishes at 59 worship sites in the study area, all of Baltimore City and some close-in parishes in Baltimore County, were briefed on the latest proposal April 9th, moving the process from the draft stage to a time for recommendations to Archbishop William E. Lurie. The latest iteration envisions 21 parishes at 26 worship sites. Pastors presented the proposed map to their parishioners the weekend of April 13 and 14. Pastors or personnel have not been assigned to any of the draft parishes, as the final parish boundaries have not been discussed. Archbishop Lurie will take into account parishioner feedback from several upcoming prayerful public sessions and make his final decision on the proposal in June. For more information about Seek the City, the proposed reconfiguration of parishes, and the location of the public sessions, visit seekthecity.org. That's seekthecity.org. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, I'm Kevin Parks.
This is Archbishop William Lurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Review Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Review Radio. I'm George Matisek. We're talking today to Hanel Bianchi. He is the author of St. George's Day, A Cultural History of England's National Holiday, and he is also a parishioner of St. John in Westminster. And with the Feast of St. George right around the corner on April 23rd, we're taking a look at the saint, St. George. Now, how did St. George become so popular, and why has his popularity waxed and waned over the centuries?
One of the disadvantages is the fact that we don't know a lot about his life, but that actually turns into a strength in terms of the promotion of St. George. So he's kind of a little bit of a blank slate. So, like I said, in the West, he becomes really popular with the Crusades, and then he's brought back to these other countries, but they don't know a lot about him. And so they end up filling out the stories a little bit in the different countries. So I know a lot about it, for example, in England. And he all of a sudden visited England, right? We don't have that in the records, but then you say, I think he's a Roman soldier and the Roman army was in Southern England. So he visited as a soldier. And so he's one of us. He's like one of our saints. And then you can have like the Ethiopian records of St. George that say that actually he was from Ethiopia, not from Turkey. So he's all of a sudden an Ethiopian saint. So you look at all these different countries and they can kind of like claim him, because the records are kind of a little bit shaky. So that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is that the people that he patronized become the most important people in society in the late Middle Ages. So you have, yes, he was associated with farming, okay, George Farmer. And there's, great traditions of blessing fields, because it's also at the beginning of spring. April 23rd is the planting and springtime. And so people would bless fields at this time. People actually, like the Feast of St. Francis, would bless their animals at this time. So that appealed to the peasants. But his main followers were the knights. And they are the wealthiest people, the most powerful people. And so what you have is they're going to patronize different churches. So you see churches throughout Europe, most famously in Windsor Castle. You've got St. George's Chapel, the most important chapel in England. It's St. George. The monarch bestowed this on them, and they got a relic of St. George, and it was a place of pilgrimage. So all these people are going to build churches dedicated to him, monasteries dedicated to him, guilds, medieval guilds, knightly orders. And so the fact that he was a patron of the most powerful people in Europe means that his cult was kind of fostered. So it's the kind of the flexibility within his cult, the grand story that he represents, but also the people that were most important were also geared to him and kind of, I guess, would be benefiting and donating to his organizations.
What are some of the ways that St. George has been celebrated over the centuries? I know there's probably a lot of different kinds of festivals and things like that. What are some of the unique ways he's been recognized?
Right. So at first, as a Catholic, I would say, all right, let's celebrate his as a religious holiday. So there's going to be always special prayers commemorating him as a martyr. So you'll find this in the Mass readings, the Liturgy of the Hours, and it became a very prominent religious holiday. The church was a little bit more localized before, like the Council of Trent, and definitely with Vatican II. And so where a city where he was a patron or a country where his patron, his saint was, his feast day was the highest rank. Right now we have the Solemnity, but there was like a double max feast day, which meant that you had to go to church. It was a holy day of obligation in these countries. Okay. It was one day that you would also be prohibited from going to work. So this is the case in England, where he is the national holiday. Everybody would stop working and you had to go to church. So this is, I think there's, yes, there's all these cultural elements, but let's not lose sight of also the religious festivals. The big thing was parades and procession. In the Middle Ages, they loved this. So there was a couple days that you would go and have religious processions, whether it would be a statue, whether it would be a relic of St. George, if you're fortunate to have a relic. And these were some of the biggest days for processions. I'd say like an example of this that has survived is Corpus Christi. That's the one day that kind of persisted, but the St. George processions, they'd also put on a lot of plays. So even now throughout Europe, they put, especially when you get the dragon story, they would reenact the battle with St. George and the dragon. And this still exists in many cities across Europe, not just in England, but also other cities that have his patronage, and in Georgia, the country, and Ethiopia as well. And then, as I mentioned, you'd also have all those spring kind of elements too, with farming and blessings of animals and fields, kind of corresponding with spring and kind of the new year, and just blessing the land again, because his name means farmer. Mm-hmm.
It seems in recent decades, there's been a revival of interest in St. George in England. Is that right? Is there sort of a renewed interest in St.
Yeah,
George?
For sure. So I would say, and I think you kind of asked about this, and I'm going to come back to it. Why has it actually dropped off? I think you said, why was he popular? But why has it also dropped off? Unfortunately, with the Protestant Reformation, he was attacked because he didn't have the strongest historical records. And with the Protestant Reformation, they just want to focus in on, like in England, for example, the apostles or Jesus, and all saints were kind of attacked. So he was kind of diminished as a saint, but the actual cultural element was so strong that he became just the knight. They got rid of the martyr part and the saint and the veneration, and they kept the knight part. So they still had stories about a knight saving a princess, but he was no longer a saint and he wasn't venerated. So the Reformation and all the Reformation countries in Northern Europe, unfortunately, the devotion to the saints declined. And St. George was a victim of that. But then in the modern period, people have kind of rediscovered St. George. And for a lot of reasons I'm not entirely comfortable with, but I think I'll take anything for the revival of St. George. Part of it is English nationalism. So you have British, which is different than English. And so you have the British Isles was kind of this multinational, but now people are reasserting their English nationalism. So that's part of it. Also, people have looked at St. Patrick's Day and say, oh, look at this Irish festival. Why don't we kind of reinvigorate St. George's Day as kind of equivalent to that? And again, it's a lot of companies like beer companies that are kind of like, well, we can see a lot of alcohol So unfortunately, the biggest promoters of St. George's, St. Patrick's Day is Guinness, right? And with St. George's Day, it's all these pubs in England, they're really promoting it. But all of this is greater attention to St. George's also kind of piqued people's interest and to look at the history and realize, oh my gosh, he's actually a real person. There's a lot of historical evidence. Yes, we don't know exactly the facts, but we know he was a real person. So even though the initial motivation might not be great, there's this general interest, which I think is a good thing, bringing it back to the saint.
Now, St. George is the patron saint of soldiers, and I know he's the patron saint of Boy Scouts. Does he have other patronages?
Yeah, I think in general, he's got a lot. But I think those, he's across many different countries and cities. He's also part of the of knights of different societies, the Order of the Garter, which is the most preeminent knightly order. So he has a lot of patronage, right? And also the scouting thing as well. There was a little bit of a revival of St. George in late 1800s and with the English Empire. And I know scouting is kind of intertwined with this, and there was the Royal Society of St. George was also founded at this particular time. So that's also the connection at the same time that the scouting is being revived. St. George is also done in an imperial version. Unfortunately, that version of St. George is not religious, and it's more kind of nationalistic. And so that's why some English people were kind of a little bit like, maybe we should switch our patron. He seems to be like racist. And then people all of a sudden looked at him. He's like, wait a second, he's from the Middle East. You know, he's this person that's about religious freedom in the face of this evil empire. Maybe we need more St. George and less racism and nationalism. So the when they took it over, the empire kind of took over St. George, that was like not a very authentic version of who he really was and what he represented.
St. George can seem like such a remote figure. What do you think he says to modern people? How can he resonate with people today?
It's a great question for Catholics. So I think in the right around the year 300, during the persecutions of Diocletian, we had the most horrendous kind of attack on Catholics and Christians in the whole history of the Roman Empire, right? And so what we see in St. George is somebody that is fearless. He's part of the military establishment. He's willing to sacrifice his role. Some people have speculated that he was pretty close to the emperor, maybe part of the Praetorian Guard, and for freedom and stick up for his belief in religion, right? And he knew what was going to happen, right? It wasn't a secret what would happen if you speak out against the emperor Diocletian. So I think for us, that's a good point. I think all Christians can be inspired by it. It's this reaffirmation of your values in the face of a very intolerant government that's trying to stamp out your ability to practice your religion. Mm-hmm. So we can't lose sight of that. I would go back to that. Forget the dragon slaying, forget the knight. Those are cool stories. You can tell your kids that. Let's go back to the authentic St. George and his story and what he represented and why we venerate him as Catholics.
What has doing this research done for your own Catholic faith, especially your connection to St. George?
Well, yeah, I mean, I spent so much time with him, a couple of years. And so I got really close to him. But in addition to what I talked about before, the lessons from his life, I've also learned a lot about general principles of like secularization that so not specifically St. George. With that point about religious freedom, it's kind of St. George specific. But like, hey, take a look at the calendar. There's all these great feast days and these great saints. And if you want to be a great Catholic, really embellish your life by celebrating these feast days. Not just for St. Patrick's Day, eat corned beef and cabbage and stuff like that, but also pray to St. Patrick and really venerate it. And then there's all these other great saints that you can do throughout the year, right? Even if you're not English or Turkish or whatever association with St. George, celebrate that day, read his life in a book that has the lives of the saints, maybe do something like an English, food or something like that. And kind of celebrate the year of the Catholic Church. There's a great book on holidays that you are what you celebrate, you know, you are what you eat kind of, but you are what you celebrate. What are the rituals? If you just think about March Madness, the Super Bowl, you know, spring training, you know, the World Series, then you're worshiping sports. But look at your calendar and say, I'm going to celebrate St. George's Day. I'm going to celebrate Lent. I'm going to celebrate, you know, all the different feasts, Advent, Christmas, Easter, Easter season, all these things. And that's a beautiful way to live your faith. So that was kind of the argument of the text, where St. George was kind of the example. How can we reincorporate these holy days and these holy individuals back into our cultural life?
And how can people get a copy of your book?
On Amazon. So it is very scholarly. if you're interested in history and the nuts and bolts of it, go into way more detail in the historical records. But it's on Amazon is the easiest way. It's the fastest delivery that you can get.
Great. Well, our guest today has been Hanel Bianchi. He's a professor of history at Howard Community College, and he's also the author of St. George's Day, A Cultural History of England's National Holiday. Hanel, thanks so much again for being here on Catholic Review Radio.
Oh, thank you so much. It was wonderful.
For Catholic Review Radio, I'm George Matisek. Thanks for listening.
Remember the spirit of your parish community, the power of worshiping together, the warmth of friends new and old who share your faith. Join us for Mass this weekend. Visit archbell.org to find a Catholic parish near you. Feel the joy.
The Catholic Review is the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the Catholic Church full time. Pick up the monthly magazine at your parish or have it delivered to your home. Subscribe to our e-newsletter for twice weekly updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Read it today in print or online at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Tune in to Catholic Review Radio next week. Available on WMET 1160 AM and 103.1 FM. Also, WSJF 92.7 FM in the Sykesville area and WVTO 92.7 FM in Baltimore City. Check us out on SoundCloud or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Review Radio. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May Almighty God bless us and keep us always in his love.